It is Friday, March the 11th. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, Iranian missile test.
This is a very provocative act that they've done. The question of its legality in terms of the UN Security Council resolutions is debatable.
Also ahead, the more we learn about Zika, the grimmer the news. Freedom of religion under siege, plus U.S. presidential debates ahead of another multi-state vote. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Iran test-fired several missiles twice this week, and Tehran's foreign ministry says these missile tests do not violate the international nuclear deal reached last year. A spokesman for the government is quoted by state media saying they were conventional developments and defensive instruments. He also said they do not violate UN Security Council resolutions. Meantime, a senior commander of the Revolutionary Guard says the country's missile program will never stop, in his words, under any circumstances. In a conversation with VOA's Victor Beatty, foreign policy scholar Jonathan Adelman of the University of Denver calls the missile test a discouraging development in light of the recent elections.
On one hand, we were encouraged by the election results, despite the fact that they took thousands of moderates and wouldn't let them run. All 30 reformers won in Tehran. They did well in the big cities. That was a victory, we could say, for the people who wanted the pact. But when they hear this kind of thing, it sounds like, kind of like the French say, plus ça change, plus ça reste le même. You know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And the elite is clearly reading into it. And if you notice what they said that this is outside of the range of the pact. And strictly speaking, they could be correct, but it is well within range of Security Council resolutions that go back as far as 10 or 20 years. So I think it's not clear what the outcome is going to be, but this is very discouraging because we'd hope that they would move in a more moderate direction under Rouhani.
Do you anticipate more ballistic missile tests?
Absolutely. The Iranians are doing this because they want to show that the Shiites are going to dominate the Middle East. And what you see is countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia that have scarcely been friendly to the Israelis, like the Jordanians have, they're now becoming very openly friendly because they're terrified. They don't have the military capability by themselves to develop nuclear weapons or advanced technology without the help of the United States or some other advanced First World countries.
And regional analyst Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales in Australia says these tests are a sign of the ongoing struggle in Iran between the hardliners and the more moderate factions.
And I think it's very much a domestic issue, with the right wingers determined, if they can, to remind the leadership that they haven't gone away, that they still have considerable power. This is a very provocative act that they've done. The question of its legality in terms of the UN Security Council resolutions is debatable because the Council rescinded most of the sanctions that had been imposed before and basically only ask or call on Iran not to engage in any ballistic activity.
Israel has to be concerned about this latest development because it appears to be the target of such tests.
We're not talking about nuclear-tipped missiles. We're talking about missiles with conventional capacity. And while I wouldn't want to downplay that, nobody wants to have something like that land in their city. They're not as significant as, say, a nuclear weapon. But yes, they are there to provoke the Israelis. The other point, of course, is that they're also there to remind the Saudis that their position is not entirely secure either, because Saudis are well within range of these missiles.
And meantime, the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Corker tells VOA that Iran's missile launches are sparking stronger resolve in Congress to renew and boost U.S. sanctions on Tehran. President Obama has stated repeatedly that sanctions will snap back if Iran violates the nuclear accord. Such leverage would be lost, and the Iran Sanctions Act expires at the end of the year, according to Corker. Still ahead on VOA, Canada's Prime Minister comes to town.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
President Obama has welcomed fellow progressive leader, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, to the White House for the first such state visit in nearly two decades. During an arrival ceremony on Thursday, Mr. Obama highlighted shared values, noting universal health care, freedom of religion, and diversity in both nations. In Canada's new prime minister, many see a younger Obama. Like the U.S. president, 44-year-old Trudeau campaigned on a similar message of hope and change. His Liberal Party swept Canada's parliamentary election last October, unseating Prime Minister Stephen Harper and his Conservative Party, who had been in power since 2006. VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey was nearby and describes more about the Trudeau visit to International Edition host Sarah Williams.
Well, first of all, it's getting a lot of attention because this is the first such state visit by a Canadian leader to the White House in 19 years, so you can imagine. And then this is the new Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, who's said to be a young, you know, version of Barack Obama. Trudeau won an election based on a campaign of hope and change with very similar parallels to how President Obama came to office here in the United States. So there's a lot of excitement surrounding that. But at the same time, like you said, there is a hefty agenda to talk about during the state visit. And some of the key issues that they're going to touch on during talks include climate change, boosting trade, and also the fight against the Islamic State militant group in Syria and Iraq.
And what about discussions about the migrant crisis?
Well, obviously that has garnered a good amount of attention, especially with the Canadian Prime Minister's approach to it. I mean, just months into taking office, he was seen at the airport in Canada, in Toronto, greeting Syrian refugees as they came off the plane. So he's been very out front, and I think Canada has met its goal of admitting 25,000 Syrian refugees into the United States, and some have contrasted that with the United States, with some of the politicians in the U.S., saying they're not okay with Syrian refugees coming in. So they've contrasted the policy between the U.S. and Canada in this regard. That, of course, is going to be an issue that's going to be talked about, the Syrian crisis in general. And U.S. officials, including President Obama, have praised Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau for the reception and for the assistance that Canada has offered to Syrian refugees and the humanitarian effort that they've contributed, and also the military contributions that they've made in the fight against these Islamic State.
Well, now, it won't be all work, because tonight there's going to be a state dinner. I'm sure there's quite a bit of interest in that.
There is, as there always is. They've already unveiled the menu with, you know, some Canadian takes. You know, you have Canadian whiskey and maple playing a role on the menu. And then, of course, you'll have the two first ladies, Michelle Obama and Gregoire Trudeau here. So there's always an anticipation of what, I hate to say, what the first ladies will be wearing, and obviously the decor. This will be the 10th state dinner of President Obama's time here, and it'll be the first for a Canadian head of state since 1997.
That is VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey. She was speaking with my colleague, Sarah Williams. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondence, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Scientists are making new discoveries about the Zika virus on an almost daily basis. And the more they learn, it seems, the more frightening that virus becomes. VOA's Carol Pearson reports that there's nothing quick or easy about combating Zika or the mosquito that carries it.
Since the World Health Organization declared the mosquito-borne Zika virus a public health emergency, scientists have linked it to paralysis and brain infections in adults. But the virus has saved its most horrifying outcome for developing fetuses. A study at Johns Hopkins Medicine in Baltimore showed that Zika infects and kills the very cells that form the developing brain. Another study involving pregnant women in Brazil showed abnormalities in 29% of the fetuses of women who tested positive for the Zika virus and who had ultrasound examinations. Dr. Anthony Fauci at the National Institutes of Health says that number is very concerning.
We're almost certain that there are going to be lesser degrees of more subtle abnormalities that may not be picked up on Doppler ultrasound. So I think that the actual incidence of deleterious effects on the fetus is going to be considerably higher than just 29%.
These abnormalities could include poor vision, deafness, low intellect, and more that will affect even babies who appear normal. His advice offers little hope, especially for poor women in Latin America and the Caribbean.
Don't get infected. Get a vaccine to prevent infection. That's the best way to do it.
Right now, there is no vaccine. And even though work is rapidly progressing, it's still 2 to 3 years before one might be available. The only other way to protect against the virus includes wearing long pants and long-sleeved shirts, using mosquito repellent, and killing the vectors, the mosquitoes and their larvae. Another issue is money. Congress has not yet provided additional funds to continue the research. Without funding, this work will slow down or even stop. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
The UN Special Investigator on Freedom of Religion or Belief is calling for the universal repeal of blasphemy laws. That story now from Lisa Schlein at the UN in Geneva.
Human rights expert Heine Bielefeld says freedom of religion and freedom of expression are mutually reinforcing, allowing both rights to flourish, but that blasphemy laws cast a pall over these basic rights. He says religious minorities suffer most from the chilling effects the laws create. Bielefeld says Pakistan is known for its draconian blasphemy laws that even carry the death penalty. Although the ultimate sentence has never been carried out, he says many people accused of blasphemy are on death row. The investigator says studies show that religious minorities in Pakistan who suffer disproportionately from the laws include Shias, Christians, and Ahmadis, who are accused of not being true Muslims. But he notes numerous countries in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, Central Asia, and even Europe have blasphemy laws on the books. He says Germany, Denmark, Poland, and Greece either have laws that hark back to the old colonial period or what he calls post-blasphemy laws. These, he says, are not meant to honor God, but to protect religious feelings. He tells VOA that Russia also has tightened its blasphemy laws.
Russia, also in the Human Rights Council, now really has taken over the torch from Pakistan to argue for the protection of the feelings of ordinary believers, which means mainly, of course, Orthodox believers. So usually these blasphemy laws protect majorities, the feelings of majorities, while minorities pay the price.
In the interest of clarity and credibility, Bielefeld says European countries should clean up the old-fashioned blasphemy and post-blasphemy laws as the Parliamentarian Assembly of the Council of Europe has demanded. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The next major test in the U.S. election calendar comes on Tuesday when 5 states hold primaries, including the delegate-rich states of Florida and Ohio. Tuesday may also be the last opportunity for those opposed to Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump to slow down his march to the party nomination. More now from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
Donald J. Trump.
Fresh off his latest victories in Michigan, Mississippi, and Hawaii, Donald Trump is reaching out to a Republican establishment that continues to oppose him.
I think it's time to unify. We have something special going in the Republican Party, and unfortunately, the people in the party, they call them the elites, or they call them whatever they call them, but those are the people that don't respect it yet.
I love the poorly educated.
That's really what Donald Trump is all about. He thinks we're fools.
Trump remains the target of a well-funded ad campaign, hoping to slow his roll to the party nomination. Ohio Governor John Kasich could help the effort by winning his home state primary on Tuesday.
And I want you to know I'm going to continue to run a positive campaign and not get down in the gutter and throw mud at anybody.
The other piece in the Stop Trump strategy involves a come-from-behind win by Florida Senator Marco Rubio in his home state.
We are not going to defeat her. If we nominate someone that over 60% of our party rejects and a third of our party refuses to ever vote for.
Who are these people? Where do they come from?
But the latest polls give Trump a big lead in Florida, while Kasich and Trump are close in Ohio. Stopping Trump on March 15th still looks like a long shot, says John Fortier.
Right now, Donald Trump is likely to win a lot of states, and the other three divide the vote, and that is a recipe for being the nominee of the Republican Party.
Trump's rise continues to divide the party, says analyst Henry Olson.
Absolutely, the party's on the verge of tearing itself apart. That what Trump is doing is basically saying that the questions the party has asked itself over the last 30 years, which is to say, how much should we apply conservative philosophy to public policy, he's saying that that's irrelevant.
I say let's come together, folks.
The anti-Trump strategy involves a contested party convention in July, but that could backfire, says Alan Lichtman.
If the Republicans wrest the nomination away from the clear vote leader, that would be disaster for them. They would go into the general election looking like a bunch of oligarchs who are denying the voice of the people.
Thank you, everybody.
Experts say that Trump victories in both Ohio and Florida on Tuesday would likely remove any doubt that he will be the Republican nominee. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Donald Trump, along with the other Republican Party presidential contenders, held another debate Thursday night in advance of the Tuesday multi-state vote. And the Democratic Party candidates for president, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, faced off the night before. Let's check in now with International Edition's G. Abby Lee about what's being said online about the Democrats in debate. Hey, G, before we get to that, what about Clinton's and Sanders' level of influence on Twitter?
Hi, Steve. Secretary Clinton has about 4 million followers and Senator Sanders on Twitter with 5.6 million followers. Also, she was definitely better known throughout the world, even before joining the presidential race.
That's a big difference, said G. So, who won that debate?
The answer on social media seems to be Senator Sanders. The New York Times at NY Times on Twitter tweeted, "Who won the Democratic debate? Bernie Sanders gets the edge." And he shared a link to an article by the same title. So let's check out a couple of replies to that tweet. One person wrote, "Seriously, he says the same thing over and over. HRC, meaning Hillary Clinton, had intelligent answers. I used to like him, and now it's all over." Another person wrote, "Are you seriously asking who won? Bernie Sanders knocked Hillary Clinton out like Prince Nassim," referring to a former professional boxer. Steve, the NYT was not the only influential media outlet that came to that conclusion. The Washington Post had an article titled, "Four Reasons Hillary Clinton Lost a Democratic Debate."
Well, if the Washington Post contends that Hillary Clinton lost the Democratic debate, it's not surprising that they could have that contention because Sanders received a standing ovation for his closing remarks, right?
That's right. He shared a clip of the closing remarks on Facebook and Twitter with a caption reading, "This is why I am running for President of the United States of America. Hashtag debate with Bernie." That's been retweeted some 10,000 times and liked by more than 15,000 people.
And what about Hillary Clinton's reaction?
She didn't really share any clips from Wednesday night, but tweeted in defense of her paid speeches to Wall Street. She tweeted, "When someone says you're beholden to banks, but NY Times says your Wall Street plan is tougher."
You know, that's interesting. It's usually the other way around, with Clinton sharing more on Twitter.
Absolutely. His Twitter page is less prolific and visual compared to Clinton's, who runs a very savvy Twitter campaign. That's all for me today. Steve?
And many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You know, you can follow G on Twitter. She is at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
With fur prices at 10-year lows, fashion designers are testing the catwalks in hopes the fur market is warming up. Mark Oten, CEO of the International Fur Federation, is optimistic because models wrapped in mink and celebrities cuddled with fox are good signs of things to come.
So that normally means that in about a year's time, the shops will be full of fur.
Fur sales in Britain are strong, but the world's largest exporter, producer, and buyer of fur, China, saw a 5% drop in revenue and a 15% drop in exports in 2015 from the previous year. Still, Henry Sun, general manager of Hong Kong Fur Factory, says now's a golden opportunity to place orders.
I think when the economy picks up a little bit, price will go again and business will be good.
Despite anti-fur campaigns, the fur industry is a multi-billion dollar business that employs about 1 million people worldwide. For VOE's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Hello, everyone. Good to have you with us today. Representatives for producer Dr. Luke have denied that Sony Music will end its relationship with him after allegations of sexual abuse emerged in a court case involving pop rocker Kesha. International Edition's David Byrd and VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee talk about Kesha's case and has it raised the specter of sexism and mistreatment of women in the music business.
She alleges that he was psychologically abusive, and then the lawsuit, she also claimed that he drugged and raped her. And this has been going on now for over a year. Recently, and this was probably in the last few weeks or so, Kesha was in court. She was asking to be released from her contract from Kemosabe Records, which is Dr. Luke's label on Sony. But the judge denied the preliminary injunction. So she was not allowed to be released from her contract. But Sony said, you can work, but just not with Dr. Luke. She has 6 more albums that she's required to complete for Kemosabe and also for Sony. And as a result of this, quite a few very powerful women in the industry have come out.
Including people like Kelly Clarkson.
Right, have come out in support of her. Taylor Swift, I think, gave her $250,000 for her legal fees. Lady Gaga has come out publicly in support of her. Adele has come out publicly in support of her. And Kelly Clarkson, who was interviewed in Australia, said, hey, he's not a very nice guy. I had to work with him. I didn't want to, but Sony insisted. In fact, they blackmailed me. Those were her words. So there are some reports now that Sony plans to end their relationship with Dr. Luke ahead of their the expiration date of the contract, which will be sometime next year. Now, Sony has not confirmed nor denied this, but these are the reports, and people are speculating that this is probably because this has become a PR nightmare for the label, for Sony.
And Sony doesn't like bad PR. I mean, it's like, we want everything to stay stable. We want everybody to be happy, and mm-hmm. let's all get along, because
right.
in the end, Sony is not in business to make artists happy, even though making the artist happy is important.
Yeah.
Sony is in business to sell CDs or downloads or vinyl records or whatever format you choose to consume their music on. And anything that interrupts that process, it's just like the Takata airbag thing with Honda.
Mm.
Honda had to call back a whole bunch of cars because there was something wrong with the cars, and they don't want their brand being associated with something bad. Am I right in that?
You're absolutely right. And that's exactly what's happened. I mean, this is a huge story, not only in the pop music world, but folks who are inside the music industry are watching this very closely, because this is one of the first times where we've actually seen the inner workings of the industry. There are other artists who have come out, not against Dr. Luke, but other female artists who have come out to say, you know, this is kind of par for the course. And so Kesha has become sort of a shero for many of the women in the industry. Now, I think it's very important, however, to say that Dr. Luke denies all of the allegations. And Sony, a representative for Sony, came out to say, we have no evidence that what Kesha is alleging is actually true. So right now, it really is he said, she said.
Okay, well, that's where we'll have to leave it for right now. If you have any comments on this, you can send Shauna a tweet. She's at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at VOA underscore music. And you can look for her show, The Soul Lounge, on our website, voanews.com.
And indeed, you ought to check it out, The Soul Lounge. Thanks, Dave, and thanks to you, Shauna. Couple of more items for you. Filmmaker Steven Spielberg has been chosen to give this year's Harvard commencement speech. Three-time Academy Award winner scheduled to do that on May the 26th. He is just one of many from Hollywood picked to give these marquee commencement addresses. Actor Matt Damon scheduled to speak on June 3rd at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Those two schools only a few blocks apart. Listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Human rights abuses in Russia under President Vladimir Putin have deteriorated significantly in the last year, said Deputy Assistant Secretary for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Rob Bershinsky. The Russian government has stepped up efforts to suppress political opposition, suffocate civil society, silence independent voices, and stigmatize members of minority groups. The list of non-governmental organizations that have been designated as so-called foreign agents has risen to over 120, including the Committee of Soldiers' Mothers, the election monitoring group Golos, and human rights organization Memorial. The Undesirable Foreign Organizations Law, introduced last May, has already led to the banning of four significant foreign donor organizations and a decision by two foundations that were major funders of Russian civil society to cease their operations there. Pressure also continues on independent media outlets. The national blacklist of blocked websites is growing, and state propaganda is becoming more virulent. Those who attempt to speak out against these alarming trends or question government policy, especially regarding Russia's aggression in Ukraine, are subject to harassment, prosecution, and physical threats. Late last year, a court sentenced activist Ildar Dadin to 3 years in prison for participation in peaceful protest. The climate of impunity in Russia has deepened, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Bershinsky. While arrests have been made in the murder case of opposition leader Boris Nemtsov, the organizers of this crime have yet to be brought to justice. The best way to honor the memory of Mr. Nemtsov, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Bershinsky, is to support human rights, democratic principles in Russia, and international norms. The Obama administration will continue to uphold those norms. Sanctions will remain in place for Russia's aggression in eastern Ukraine until Russia fulfills its commitments under the Minsk agreements. And the sanctions imposed on Russia for its occupation of Crimea will remain in place until that occupation has ended. In addition, the United States will continue to speak out publicly against repressive laws and practices in Russia that impede the work of civil society and independent media. The United States will also continue to hold Russians accountable for their roles in the imprisonment and death of Sergei Magnitsky and other gross violations of human rights. It is in America's interest to see a strong, prosperous, and democratic Russia emerge, a Russia that can be a reliable partner in support of global peace, the type of Russian dream to which Boris Nemtsov and many other activists have devoted their lives.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.